dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers.
To the hackers and the crackers.
I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll sue you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISO? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack.
This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial code, source codes, ISOs, RANs, SIPs, SIPs. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
We are back once again this week, ladies and gentlemen, with Binary Revolution Radio. I am Stank Dog, fully recovered from my off week last week. I had the bird flu or something. I don't know what I had last week, but we did not get a show out last week. However, today, March 6, 2007, you are going to get two episodes for the price of one, and considering that one is free, so are two. Doubleheader episode this week that'll keep us back on the path, keep us on track as far as keeping a weekly release of the show out, even though we all know that that's an out-and-out lie, and I'm a son of a bitch for even saying that on the air. But what are you going to do? And this is actually going to be kind of an interesting week for the show because the back-to-back episodes that we're going to do, again, this is 188, and we have a new first-time co-host on episode 188 with me, and that co-host is Mubix. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
And Mubix and I have been chatting with chatting in IRC and actually here on Bell's Mind quite a bit lately, and we came up with some cool stuff to talk about for the show tonight, so we're going to get into that a little bit later on. But the other reason this double header is a little bit interesting is this is kind of a Hack 5 double header spectacular, if you will, because the second episode, episode 189 coming up, is from our good friend Droops, who recorded an episode with the gang over at Hack 5. So stay tuned for that in about an hour and a half from now. What else do we have in housekeeping? We are going to... Oh, we made some forum changes. Once again, controversial forum changes. It seems to be anything I ever change is controversy. But made some changes to the forums. Basically, we've... You know, I think a lot of our regular listeners and regular visitors to the forum know that we've had some problems where we've just outgrown our hardware. We've upgraded to new hardware. And I'd rather not have to upgrade again, so what I'm doing is kind of cracking down and getting a little bit more efficient with the system and the hardware that we have. So every little minor change along the way that can help me keep the server running smoothly for our actual registered users, the users that we want to serve most, the users that actually care and show support, we want to try to provide the best experience that we can. So to that end, we have basically taken the biggest forums that we have and still kept them publicly available. We want information to be free. We want people to be able to find it, Google and that sort of thing, which is great. So we put all of the big forums out there, the top five forums, and made them publicly available just as they always have been. Anybody can browse and read that information. But what we've done is we've taken all of the other forums, the smaller ones, the more focused forums where they're actual members working on things together and sharing information on specific topics, and we've made it so that you have to register with the forums to get access to those, so even to browse them or read them. Now, I don't see why that's a big deal. It's not like we're charging money. Anybody can register for free. That's not a big deal in my opinion, but there's some people out there, ironically registered members, who don't seem to like this, so... Not sure what to tell you about that, but in the long run, it's going to help a lot of different things. It's going to have less traffic from people that are finding some of the code that we're working on. A lot of the projects down there are being discovered while they're still in progress, while there's work going on. So they're getting shut down quickly, and they don't work anymore. So, you know, a lot of these projects are getting ruined because people are coming from nowhere, finding them, or or stealing the work and taking it somewhere else, which is something we don't want to do. So it's just kind of like, I don't know, there's several different reasons in my mind to do it. And the bottom line is, you know, if you're visiting the site so much that you're frequenting all of those other forums, then I don't see why it's a big deal to register. I mean, show some support, register for the site. Doesn't really change anything. It's just, basically, it's what it is, showing support. I've seen a lot of other forums out there that require registration to access anything at all, period. So, you know, it's we're still giving out the majority of information in the top five forums, which is easily 75% of the content of the site, still out there for anybody to access anywhere, anytime, which is great. The only other thing that was brought to my attention is that somebody said they don't like to log into the servers from a public location. They don't want to send their password, plain text, or any of that kind of stuff. So that I certainly understand, and that's a valid concern. We are in the process of putting a self-signed SSL certificate. Actually, we already have one. We're just in the process of slapping that on the forums so that people can log in securely from anywhere as well. So that should alleviate that problem. So if that's the only concern, that is something that is certainly fixable. But if you want to access all those other forums, hey, just register and everything's fine. Everything's honky-dory. So the information's free no matter, you know, either way you do it. Just register and show a little support. I'm tired of seeing at the bottom of the forums we have 120 users or 120 people browsing the forums, but only, you know, 14 registered. You know, we've got all these people that are just putting a load on the server. Well, those 14 people that are registered to me deserve a little bit more respect and support from us, so I want to make their experience as good as possible, as fast as possible. I'm not going to let those other 100 and some people slow the server down for them. They're welcome to come browse the information in the top five forums, but I'm not going to let them go in there and research and get down to the details if they're not even going to show the courtesy to register for the site. So I understand some people aren't going to like it, but hey, what can I tell you? Deal with it.
I got a real quick point.
Sure.
For the person who doesn't want to send their password over clear text to the server, until you have SSL there, later on in the show, we'll have a really easy way to do that from a public location.
Cool. Very cool. Well, then that's a good good timing to do the show. We'll talk about this subject, which is a bunch of useful applications that you can put on your USB tool. That's going to be our main topic, a USB key, a bunch of useful tools that you can carry around with you and that serve purposes just like that, a very specific purpose and that you can use from anywhere, anytime. But if you didn't, unless you had some housekeeping as well?
Nope, no housekeeping first time.
So why don't we move into some email?
Email@binred.com.
And our first email this week comes from NJAK. I guess that's a name. Is that an acronym, NJAK? NJAK. I'm going to call him NJAK. All right, NJAK. I have
named.
Yeah, NJAK. I have, or Ninja K. No, it's just NJ, whatever. NJAK. Who says, I wish to ask, I love just trying to figure out the names of people that write in. NJAK. It can't be that hard, but I'll make it complicated because that's what I do. NJAK says, I wish to ask the question, why don't computers encrypt using images, sound, touch, taste, and even smell? Figure that in a key, you don't have to use any characters and symbol. What takes the place of characters? Can look like... Wait a minute, what?
Can look like the same to the human eye.
Can look like the same to the human eye. So why not just assign A to Y equals M... and then give it a color value, pound 0000XX, where XX is 1Z to 33Z. Z is a random integer between 1 and 3. Next, do the same with B and so on. Every character in theory could be Y equals M with a color value of pound 0000001. Then a picture could then be displayed with an interval based on character. So, if you encrypted the name StankDog, quote-unquote StankDog, to a computer, would read it as Y equals M, comma, #000001, comma, at x equal x plus 0 seconds, I guess that is, y equals m, #000001, at x equals x plus 0.3 seconds. That would be the t, I guess, he's, what if I'm following him here. Y equals m, comma, #000001, at x equals x plus 1 second. And I'm not going to read all these, so on and so forth. But to an end user, that is just one black line. I see there being a lot of possibles given this mode of thinking. Now, I could go way deeper into this, but for now, why can't StankoDog equal 12 pixels, bark, quote, bark, smooth, bitter, and mint? Just throwing out an idea in Jack.
I think he's saying that you're smooth, you're bitter, and you're...
and minty? And stank at the same time somehow.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not... I gotta be honest, I'm not quite sure I'm exactly following you. I mean, let's back up a little bit. We've talked about a topic, steganography, on the show a few times in the past. So, anytime that you're hiding information inside of other file types, most commonly images, but it can certainly be music, video, or anything like that, the term is steganography, and you can hide data in there in multiple different ways. Usually it's a matter of least significant bits, but gosh, I don't want to go into too much detail because it would take a whole show in and of itself again, and I think, again, we've done that before. But there are a lot of ways that you can hide data in images, and the person on the other end would have to know the algorithm or the way that you put that data in there, and it's something that you can't really see. It does not sound like that's what you're describing here, InJack. It sounds like what you're describing is, I don't know, I'm not quite sure I can see how the computer could easily encode and then subsequently decode this. I can see how a human might be able to decode this if they know the pattern or if they know the detail of it, but I'm not sure how easy this would be to automate and write a program to do this. Am I interpreting this email right? Are you on the same page as me, or are you seeing something different here? Obviously, computers can't tell smells and tastes and touch and things like that. So those are kind of sort of out of the question. Now, to use the graphics example that he talks about, I mean, you could say if this pixel has this color in it, then it represents this letter and things like that, but I'm just not sure. You still would have to have a pattern to know. You'd have to have some kind of key to tell it which pixel is worth which value, so you'd have to have some sort of key. So in that aspect, it's not really any different than simple or basic public key encryption. So I'm just not quite sure I understand it. So in Jack, I guess the best thing, I'm not sure really. I would think that this is a little bit too complicated to answer in an email, especially with the specifics that you're talking about here. I think this might be something good to open up on the forums, start a thread in the forums, because it is definitely an interesting idea. And let's see, maybe if it'll come across better with a little bit more detail, typed out in a little bit more detail, maybe some examples. So I think that's probably the best way to go with that one. let's see, how about we move on to email number 2 from Wiccan 2, Wiccan2. Oh, that would be my Windows Vista box over there blinking at me in the background, if anybody heard that. But they're going to have to wait. Wiccan 2 says, to StankDog and co-host, you said in episode 187 that technology such as body enhancements is going to be available generations from now, but it is actually closer than we think. I saw a seminar last November called Upgrading Humans, where Professor Kevin Warwick had designed and built an implant that allows him to interface his nervous system to a computer. During his experiments, he was able to use ultrasound to detect objects by using a baseball cap fitted with ultrasound sensors, and he was able to remotely control a robotic hand across the internet. His nervous system was assigned an IP address, He was situated in America, and the hand was situated in the UK. Just by thinking about moving the hand would respond. He was also able to use a limited form of communication with his wife on a nervous system to nervous system level. Through his work, he claims to be the world's first cyborg and believes that human-computer enhancements will be available in the not-too-distant future. From the work that is being done around the world, body hacking could become reality sooner than we think. And he gives a couple links at the end of this email, kevinwarwick.com, Professor Warwick's site, it's kevinwarwick.com, and there is also a Wikipedia entry for Kevin Warwick as well. Keep up the good work at the DDP, Wiccan 2. Well, thank you for the email, Wiccan 2, I appreciate it. Just to clarify, though, I know I said last week that it is generations off, but just to clarify, I'm saying that it's not going to be publicly available for a few generations. It's going to be quite a while before this is something that's rolled out and you can go into the hospital and get. It's going to be at least a full generation, if not probably even more. That's not a comment on the technology. I think there's actually several people out there, all right, maybe not several, but a few, a handful, that are doing things like this to themselves and volunteers on a very small scale and developing a lot of this stuff. I think we said that a lot of this stuff is actually garage development type stuff. But what I was really more commenting on was the price of doing these things and the relationship with our healthcare system and our insurance system, which is a horribly, horribly corrupt system, and the prices are mandated and controlled by the American government anyway, has got their hands tied into this. So what I was trying to say anyway was that this is probably generations off before any normal, everyday person is able to go into a hospital because they have headaches and get a chip in their brain that's going to prevent headaches in the future or something like that, or you know, permanent vision correction by putting like a cybernetic chip or some kind of lens in their eye to permanently correct their vision. These type of things, I think, are still a ways off because there's just too many hoops that you have to jump through in this country to get those things rolled out. But, I mean, that's my opinion, but I, you know, what do I know? I mean, Mubix, have you heard any stories of people like this, or do you know any cyborgs? That's a funny question.
You know, I do not know anybody, but this scares me. It brings back flashbacks of Johnny Mnemonic and, like, people going crazy with this stuff. And, you know, I don't even have any tattoos because I don't like changing my body because I think it does stuff. But, you know,
well, that's
putting technology in you is not something I am looking forward to at all. Just personal opinion there.
Well, and, you know, there's a whole nother topic that we won't go down this road of, you know, hacking the human body that's been upgraded and cyborged. I mean, planting a virus and controlling, what if I hacked into this guy's, whatever is the IP address of the hand, and I start choking,
nervous system.
Yeah, or I grab this remote hand over the internet and start choking his wife with it. I mean, there's a lot of, I don't know, it's all kind of fiction right now, and it's funny to say, but you just don't know what the future holds. I mean, and that's, again, another reason that it's going to take a long time before this stuff kind of rolls out to the public. All of these things have to be taken into consideration. But yes, I'm with you on the, I don't have any tattoos, and, yeah, I'm not, I don't know, I mean, there's, who knows what the future holds as far as that stuff goes and what decisions you'll make. If there's a technological solution, make me a cyborg if it'll save my life, or if it'll enhance my life when I'm, you know, in some extraordinary way. I'm not completely opposed to it, but I'd have to be convinced pretty hard. I'm not going to get this LASIK surgery or anything to cut my eyes open with either, because I don't feel comfortable with it. So I feel you on that part of things.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not completely against it. I'm afraid, like, I would love to jack into the internet and see it visually and all that stuff, but I definitely am not looking forward to the hacking aspect of it.
Right. Of course, we could get like an implant for Savant and Black Ratchet, where put a little chip in their brain so that when they're...
Can they tell the difference?
Well, probably. Well, they got nowhere to go but up, if you know what I'm saying. Oh, come on, I love you guys. Give me a break. No, but we gotta put a chip in there that does nothing but synchronizes to IMDb, so they have that movie database in their head, so they don't screw up any more movie quotes. If they ever on the spot and they're recording the show and they want to do a movie quote, they can just kind of real quickly hit IMDb.com, or look up on the global interweb, if you will, or Wikipedia, even better, a better source of misinformation. But I digress. All right, our last email this week is actually, it's one of my favorite emails in a long time. Email is from Bushwick. Bushwick says, well, first of all, the following demonstration was crafted by a listener of Ben Rev Radio. The host, nor the co-host, that would be you, condone any activities of this nature. This demonstration is for educational purposes only. So, first of all, he put that disclaimer in the top of the email, so I'm going to go ahead and read it and put it out there. But
anything that doesn't get me in trouble, so
well, there you
you're
go.
Fine there.
There you go. And well, you know, we'll address this email. We'll address this email specifically because it is actually very interesting. And there's still nothing illegal in this country yet, thank God, about talking and discussing things. You know, luckily education is still not banned. Exactly. So, and truthfully, this is not really, there's nothing necessarily bad. This is an interesting idea that. Well, let me go into the email. Greetings, Stank Dog, Black Ratchet, and or other co-host. Okay, let me start again. Greetings, Stank Dog and Muvix. There we go. I'm a noob to BenRev Radio and IRC Chat, and I just got done listening to episode number 186. With a discussion about responsible disclosure, something came to mind, and I wanted to see what you two thought about this thought process. Companies, financial institutions, and various universities don't want their security flaws disclosed to the public, obviously, and various hackers, let's say black hats, don't want to follow in the footsteps of the two geniuses who thought they could extort News Corp by going to MySpace to in person to reveal a hack for money. Well, that's brilliant. Assuming that the exploit allows the black hat access to private information, name, phone number, social security number, etc., etc., what could stop a black hat from maybe not disclosing it to the companies themselves, or to try extort them directly, but maybe disclose the information to someone who could be directly affected negatively if the information were to fall in the wrong hands? A black hat could say, you know, you could profit from my discovery. A good case could be made for negligence here, and you can sue XYZ blank 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 company here for a good chunk of change. Maybe if I reveal this to you and you take them to court, you could cut me in on a portion of the judgment. Let's go one step further. Let's assume that a group of black hats were working together who would intentionally go out and register personal information on a myriad of websites, and a few of them intentionally go out and exploit those same sites to see if they could retrieve that same personal information. Then the black hat themselves go after the businesses, schools, individuals, etc. for obvious negligence. Assuming that it could be proven in a court of law, that could be a pretty hefty payday. How long would it take for companies, schools, individuals to change their policies regarding having security flaws disclosed? Great show, guys, and thanks to the BenRev IRC community for welcoming me in with open arms, even though my thought process is out there. Well, thank you for the email, Bushwick. I appreciate that. It's actually, this is a very good topic, a very interesting scenario, if you will. So, I'm actually with you. You know, let's throw out the disclaimer earlier. I'll just come out and say, I'm with you up to the part about disclosing privately to the affected companies and individuals. Okay, and let me, I need some story time music or something to throw in here. Let me share a little story here that I've never shared before. I'm going to keep it as pretty vague as possible, though. I found, actually, a flaw one time with a particular credit card company's website that gave me access to one person's account. It wasn't like it was a big widespread problem where I could access everybody's account and all these docs are dropped or anything like that, luckily. But it was a flaw that basically it was someone else at that credit card company that had a similar real name to mine. So the name on their account was very similar to mine. So it was just a kind of a silly, simple flaw, and it was easy to fix. I actually knew exactly how to fix the flaw. So going back to 186, what he's referring to here is we talked about disclosure. You know, how do you go about disclosing something like that? And, you know, again, my tendency is to keep my mouth shut and not say anything to anybody because of the fear of legal repercussions and, I don't know, judicial, you know, repercussions, going to jail or anything like that. But in this case, I was hesitant to bring it up, but what I finally did was I chose to go ahead and call, since it was one customer. It was totally accidental how I stumbled across this, and I knew how to fix it. I decided to go ahead and contact this person. So what I did is I chose to call that individual customer whose account I had accessed accidentally. I called him from a safe phone, which means basically that I dialed in from my own caller ID spoofed phone. And even with that, I did a pass-through through another caller ID spoofing service and did an out-dial to this customer. And again, I had that customer's private information in front of me. That's where the phone number came from, along with a lot of other information, as you can imagine. So I kind of routed through, you know, back in the old days, they used to call it telnet hopping from one box to another. I phone hopped through a couple different boxes, spoofing different numbers along the way. I called him up and basically explained to him what had happened, and as little detail as possible, and obviously he was very shocked at first. I mean, he didn't even know if this was a prank or a joke or whatever. So I basically told him what the situation was and how he could easily fix it. I gave him some of the information from his account to prove that it was, you know, that I was really seeing it. And I even told him, you know, call the credit card company and complain about it, because this is a pretty serious thing. I told him that I hadn't changed anything, you know, it was nothing like that, and I was logged out of it, never going to do it again. I walked him through changing it and everything, and that was the end of the story. I never followed up, I never heard anything more from it. That was it, end of story, as far as I know anyway. So why do I bring that story up? Well, the point of the story is, going back to what Bushwick said in his email, disclosing the information to a third party who was affected, in this case, this individual person, he was the third party person who was affected by this, his docs were dropped, a privacy violation. Well, some people would say that that's actually the whole point of disclosure. That's who you're serving when you disclose this information. You're not necessarily, I mean, it's noble that you want to help the company, that's great, but I don't think that's really so much, at least in my opinion, my motivation. It's to help prevent all of those innocent, I guess I can use the word victim safely here, those victims who didn't know that their identity is being so easily dropped out there or so poorly protected. So that's who you're serving. You know, keep in mind the goal. The goal is not to save the company from getting sued. The goal is to save people's privacies, at least in this case. You know, enhance people's security. That's the ultimate goal. So, you know, disclosure, depending on how you look at it, you're always helping a third party, whether it's an individual or a group. Did that make sense at all? Are you following me there?
Yeah, I'm following you. You know, this discussion in general has been a big buzz across the net. We did a Sploitcast episode on it. There's been numerous talks everywhere, just on every level of this topic, and I put my brain power to it, and the only thing that I can think of to effectively solve this problem so that you can disclose something without having repercussions is having an intermediary, basically having a non-profit organization that everybody submits to, they check it, and they submit it to the company. That way, they have like a non-disclosure agreement, so they don't disclose who submitted it, and they don't submit it, or they don't disclose it to the world as full disclosure. The company has to react on it in, said, 30 days or year or whatever, and then it goes public or something like that.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea at all.
One-on-one works.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea at all, actually. The problem with that would be finding third-party independent companies or that are trusted by both parties. If they're going to be basically puppets of the corporations or the companies, then the hackers are going to be like, why should we participate and disclose to you? We're going to do it the same way we've always been doing it. And if it's an organization set up by hackers, programmers, open source people, whatever you want to call them, the companies probably aren't going to trust and support it, because to them, they're not getting any necessary benefit out of it. There's a lot of trust going on. So it's a good idea. I would love to see that idea pursued and see if they could pull something off that's at least some sort of compromise in between. The other thing, you know, Jennifer Granick, I know, spoken about this from the Cyberlog, Cleveland Cyberlog Connects, talked about, you know, easing up some of the laws to make it not as dangerous for people to disclose things, but that's a touchy subject too. I mean, the whole subject's touchy, and again, go back to episode 186 was all about this topic, and it's something that comes up on the episode, on multiple episodes of the radio show over the past 4 years that we've been doing it. It's come and we've touched on it so many different times, so it's basically at this point, it's a personal decision. Everybody's going to have to find their own line at this point. Now, speaking of that line, to get back to this email, this is where I kind of start to disagree with the email, is when it crosses from that line, you know, disclosing to third parties the people that are affected, that's great. I support that. I agree with that in most cases. I can't think of any cases where I would not support that. But you cross a different line when you amount, when you cross, you cross a different line when you basically commit what is extortion or blackmail, which is the scenario he described. Anytime you ask to be cut in on money of any kind, whether lawsuit or asking to be paid to not disclose or selling information, information that could be used in a bad way, selling it to someone whom you know is going to use it for ill intent, you're crossing a whole different and, to me, very clear and simple ethical line there. The second, and here it is, it's very simple in my eyes, and by all means, I would welcome any email that wants to say otherwise. I'm not saying it's right, but to me, it's so clear-cut. The second that you try to profit off of any of the information, you've committed a crime. It's extortion, it's blackmail, it's so many different names to it, and ethically speaking, it's wrong. That is not what the hacker ethic is all about. The hacker ethic is about releasing that information and trying to help the people involved. It's not about using it to make money or using it to your own ends. So, and frankly, legally, that's ethically speaking. Legally speaking, the second you committed the crime, the second you accessed the site without permission, or the second you started doing the research, again, that's a whole other topic for another time. You know, we've beaten that horse to death, actually, on the show, of why is it necessarily illegal just because you did this, just because you poked around there? The way the laws are written now, they're unfortunately not in our favor for doing basic research. But I don't see that changing.
I completely agree with you there. I mean, there is that. Now, most people don't understand this like the normal population, but hackers do have lines where they have a set of ethics.
Sure, yeah. there is
so
a hacker ethic.
That definitely goes beyond even the hacker's set of ethics.
Yeah, there is definitely a hacker ethic. And it's, that's this whole misconception. I mean, I would love to see a local news story instead of doing some story about hackers committing ATM fraud or hackers stealing your credit card information or hackers blah, 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 which of course is basically they're using the word hacker as thief. I would love for them to do a story saying about hacker ethics. Maybe if they did one story like that and understood hacker ethics, they'd not make so many of those other stories. But anyway, I'm going to get off the soapbox on that one. We've beaten that horse to death too, and you're getting me fired up now, and I'm running out of iced tea. and actually, that's the last scenario that he poses in the email is a very interesting one, insofar from a research standpoint as well. And that is registering for a bunch of sites. Now, he's saying a black hat group or something. I'm just going to leave the terminology out of it. But registering for a bunch of sites to see or prove, if you already know, if they're vulnerable raises a whole nother interesting issue. Anytime you find an exploit, you have to be able to prove it. You have to be able to recreate it and show that it wasn't a fluke or an accident, that it's something that can be reproduced over and over again. And the term for that is usually a proof of concept, whether that's a bit of code, whether that's a outline of the process that you go through to get from A to B. So making a proof of concept is something that's very common. When we find an exploit and you want to prove it to everybody, you release all this exploit code out there, this proof of concept code, and that's probably the most common when you think exploit. That's the most common thing you see out there is people who've written a script to take advantage of the exploit or the vulnerability. Now, it's, again, back to the hacker ethic. It's kind of morally against that hacker ethic if you do this under the intent to somehow make money or capitalize on this information. Once again, it's about releasing the information and helping and saving people. If you have the intent to sue someone or start a class action lawsuit against someone, to use the example from the email, yes, you've crossed a whole different ethical line. But I think all of our listeners probably are knowing right now that not only is it ethically wrong, but you don't have a legal leg to stand on a case like this because, well, and maybe not. People don't know this, but it's different when you are an innocent third party victim who had no knowledge or understanding that this could happen. You have an expectation of privacy with these companies, like let's say a credit card company, for example. You have an expectation of privacy that they're going to do their due diligence to protect your personal information. But if you go in there and create accounts and put your information out there with the intent and the goal to release an exploit later on, only so that you can get caught up in a class action lawsuit or so that you can sue somebody using an exploit that you were aware of or you discovered, you're not an innocent third-party victim getting caught up in a negligence case. You knew the system was negligent, and you willingly chose to participate. I don't think that would last 10 seconds in court. Now, to go back to the email, I think he does say, assuming that it could be proven in a court of law. So I'll give you, he did say that in his statement, but I don't think that would be all that difficult to prove in a court of law because all that stuff is logged on these servers. As soon as it happened, they could easily go back in there and find out where did this come from, who did it. Oh, isn't it interesting that he created an account 2 weeks before the exploit happened or something like that. There's a lot of ways that they could find this kind of stuff. So, again, totally unethical.
I do forensics on computers all the time, and users are amazed every day at what I can find and dig up on servers, logs, computers. Just to point out to the listeners that even though you might think you're being really sneaky with what you're doing, you can get caught just as easy.
Oh, yeah. I think all of our users are well aware of that. That's why we've done episodes of wiping your hard drive out with how many passes, 7 passes, DoD standard, and 21 passes, and all that kind of good stuff. We've definitely made it clear. Now, of course, it's not something I'm going to wipe my drive every single time I use it either. That's kind of ridiculous. So, it's plausible deniability. Comes into play, and so you might want to make some sort of a pattern of it so that you can maintain that excuse. And well, anyway, I digress. We could again go into that on another show sometime, and we have in the past. So again, thanks for the email. That was really, I think that was really in depth. The no disclaimer necessary because again, learning and understanding and discussing these things, and hopefully hopefully people agree with me. I mean, people who really understand and get the hacker ethic that are real hackers, I think should agree with that or understand that, and there's nothing wrong with thinking from a different point of view or thinking from the other side, if you will, because that helps you understand where you might be missing something, where holes might be, et cetera, et cetera. So, Bushwick, thank you very much. That was one of the most interesting emails in a long time, and everybody, actually really good feedback on the show this week. However, in lieu of making an entire email show again, let's move on and do our main topic for the week, if you're ready, sir.
I am, actually.
All right. Well, and we kind of alluded to it earlier. We talked about the main topic is going to be, we're going to kind of go through a list of several and discuss several different software packages that you can throw on a USB key, stuff that's useful to hackers and in some cases useful to anybody. And that's something that you have some experience with, right?
Right. I actually am quite popular for my USB applications, the ones that I think of, I don't write them. At work and across the net. So the first one that I want to talk about TCP view. It's by SysInternals.
Well, wait a minute. Hold on. Before we go into some of the detail of it, let's talk about just some general. Like, I mean, obviously our users are technically savvy. They know what a USB key is, right? And the most useful feature, at least for me, is just moving files from one system to the other. That's mainly what I used it for. But not only can you keep handy and useful software on there, there's some software that's even designed these days to be portable, to be run from a CD or a floppy disk or a USB key, right?
A lot of applications, believe it or not, don't make any registry changes, don't make anything like that. So you can actually turn them portable. They're not already made that way. Now, portableapps.com has all kinds of portable applications that are made to do it, like portable Firefox, portable Thunderbird. But there's also any executable that only has maybe a configuration file in the same folder, or just this simple executable can be made portable, and you can take on your USB stick wherever you want.
Right. The Unix way of doing things, where all your files are right there in the folder, self-contained for the most part, with, you know, exceptions, obviously, but just a .conf file or an .ini file or whatever you want to call it in the same directory with your executable, and you're off and running.
Yeah.
Now, the other question, though, is, like, and I know from experience, I can say, I've had problems with USB drives where I pulled it out of my laptop bag and it was just completely DOA. I'd lost everything that was on it. You've been using these quite a bit, like you said, at work. You're a popular guy at work, it sounds like, when somebody wants to recover or needs anything. Have you had any USB drives go bad? And is it matter, like, the brand of USB drive? Are any better than the others? I mean, generally speaking, I mean, can you recommend one over the other, or is there any handling tips? I mean, have you ever had one die on you, I guess, is a place to start.
I've actually had many die on me. The thing that makes them die, I guess, easier or is the environment or how you use them. If you're looking for a USB thumb drive and it has, like, a flip-top stick where the USB comes out, or basically, the dongle is what dies the most, not the data on it. All it is flash. There's no moving parts.
Right.
So you got to get one that it's kind of ruggedized. It doesn't have something that if you look at it, easily break. That's the most easy way, or the way that my USBs have died the most. One time I went swimming with one. I guess that would be considered dying.
Yeah.
But
that's
not a good idea to
not
go in water
exactly.
With USB sticks.
I wonder if someone probably invented a waterproof USB stick, but I digress. So that being said, then, would you recommend, because they are volatile and because it may crash, it's like anything else, I guess you probably should have a backup somewhere, throw it to a CD or something, so if you ever buy a new USB, when one dies, you can restore easily, or?
I actually use one of my applications, one of my USB applications is DirSync, DirSync. And what I do is, it's running on my computer all the time. So whenever I have my iPod, which is where I back up all my USB sticks to,
mm-hmm.
And they're numbered, like, this is my 1 gig, this is my 8 gig, whatever, 512.
Right.
As soon as I plug in both, it sees that both are plugged in and it backs up to my iPod. So I always have a backup of my USB sticks at all times.
That's
if one
good.
Goes bad.
Well, and this also makes it easy, like, if we meet up, you can give me a copy of one of them easily, too.
That's true.
Restore it over to someone else's drive, so that's kind of handy. That's a cool thing to take to the BinRev meetings or 2600 meetings or whatever and swap some of this stuff with other people. That's pretty awesome. All right, so also then, yeah, in that same mindset then, would you recommend people just get the cheapest one they can get because they're all volatile in some way? Would you just say get the cheapest one? Don't invest a lot of money in some particular name brand? I mean, they're all, for the most part, the same?
Yeah, I would definitely get the cheapest one. And again, just make sure, however you plug it in, the USB part of it, the end of it, make sure that it's not easily broken. Because I put these through a lot of strength tests, basically, from day-to-day use, and I'm sure other people do as well. They don't take care of them. So that would be the one point that I would look for in a USB stick.
Okay, cool. All right, well, now that we kind of talked about that a little bit, let's go into the details of some of the apps that you have found useful in your experience.
All right, the first application that I got is TCP View, which is from SysInternals, which, you know, got bought out by Microsoft.
Microsoft, right.
I got the app before they got bought out, so it's still tarnished.
Un-Microsoft.
Un-Microsoft, there's a good term.
Yeah, un-Microsofted.
So, if you've ever been doing troubleshooting on a computer, and you do a netstat just to find out, or you have a virus and you want to know where it's going or what it's doing. Or basically, netstat real time is what TCPUView is, and so I can find, I can watch as connections get established, are put into time wait, or what ports I'm listening on, all kinds of stuff, and it shows me what application is doing that at the time, what protocol, what the local address is, and what the remote address is. It even does a DNS lookup on the remote address to tell me exactly where I'm going.
All on the fly.
Great tool. All actively and real time.
And this particular tool, is this one we referred to earlier where it's just having pretty much an executable in a configuration file and you can just execute it from the USB drive?
It's a zip file that you get from Microsoft now. But you just export it and you're set.
I'm curious, have you tried the Microsoft one yet?
I have not. I refuse.
I wonder just from the curiosity of how different they are.
Well, you're going to have to wait for a listener to try because I refuse.
All right. Well, and SysInternals actually made quite a few cool things before they were bought. Well, maybe that's why they were bought out. But,
yeah.
And that's also, we've talked about in the past on the shows, too, and this is definitely worth bringing back up. Like, I know one of the sites I used to like was called oldversions.com, but I'm sure there are several others now, and probably just through word of mouth and BenRev forums, places like that, finding older versions of software before they get destroyed or back when they were freeware, but when they've now become, you know, charge or shareware or pay for, you know, whatever their pricing scheme has changed, but it might have been free at first. So there's certainly a reason to keep older versions. There's reasons not to keep them, obviously, if there's security problems or bugs or flaws, but there's certainly some reasons to keep these old, stable, good, useful applications around for a period of time. You don't always have to upgrade to the latest and greatest thing all the time.
Oh, definitely. And there's a couple tools that I've kept around for a long time coming up shortly. But to get on to our next tool, it's called SmartSniff, and it's by the NurseCMD or NurseSoft guys.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really helpful to me because I was constantly going through ethereal captures or doing an ethereal capture on a computer, and I know I'm going to get flamed for this, but it's difficult going down packet by packet and looking and trying to sort them and filter it how you want it.
Well,
what SmartSniff does is basically it groups your packets together. It says this local address, this remote address, and this port is the same, so we're going to put it all. And it even has a quick preview on the bottom in ASCII, so I can say this local address, this remote address, and here's the GET statement. Oh, it's an HTTP. Got it. And I see the GET statement, the accept language, all visually right there in front of me, even the packets going right after it. Great tool. I mean, I cannot say enough about how easy this makes my life.
Right, and Ethereal, of course, now known as Wireshark, there's a little bit of a learning curve to that, and once you get the hang of it, you can, of course, combine the streams together. It'll put all the packets together for one request or one communication, so you know, it's got some power there, but it has definitely got a bit of a learning curve to it. And SmartSniff, again, is very portable.
Very portable. It's a single executable, no configuration. You don't. I mean, you can configure it, and it stores the options on a file or a registry setting, but no extra files initially.
Life easy. Yeah, you kind of bring up a good point there, too. Earlier we talked about, you know, they don't always have to write registry entries and stuff like that, but it's actually worth mentioning and keeping in mind, you actually should watch to make sure that it does not create registry entries. That's a thought to keep in mind as well, because let's say that your goal is to slip in a USB key, and I think we might talk about this later if we have time as well, to execute something covertly, quietly, without being discovered, you want to slap a USB key into someone's computer, run something, and then get out of there and not leave any signs. You want to be careful that your app isn't quietly, without your knowledge, writing a registry key out there, so that when you leave and think you've left no footprint, that it might have, in fact, put something out there in the registry. And hopefully nothing too incriminating or personal or anything like that, but even if you leave, can't think of an example. If, let's say, ethereal, which is not the case, but throws a key out there for ethereal or SmartSniff or TCP or any of these, which again, they're bad examples because I can't think of one, but if you leave a key there, that's going to potentially draw interest from somebody saying, wait a minute, something's fishy here. I've never heard of this software before.
Actually, there is a program that you can use that I use all the time, which isn't on our show notes, so we can add it later. Registry Monitor by SysInternals.
Yeah.
Every time I get a new application, USB, the application, say it again, I throw it in, run it, and using Registry Monitor with the filtering on for that specific executable, it tells me exactly what query, what set value, what create value. Everything that it does in the registry, I can see what it does, and I audit that before I start using it, because I don't like my registry all gucked up.
Right. Yeah, and there's lots of registry cleaner things out there on an unrelated note, but yes, that was another cool SysInternals tool. All right, what else you got on there?
All right. Now, I might get flamed for this, but next one up is PS Pad. The thing I like about PS Pad, again, I'm a very lazy person, so anything that makes life easy is what I use. The reason I use PS Pad is I can drag and drop any executable I want, and it's now turned into a text editor. I can drag and drop any HTML document, and it's turned into an HTML editor. And the thing that's nice about it, to add on to it, is that on the left-hand side, I can open up a FTP client right there. I can have my favorite directories and folders in. I can save my settings locally so that I can bring this whole thing around on my USB key and have my settings, have where my FTP client or my FTP server is located. All this just makes life easy. Again, I can't say enough about it.
Yeah, and it will. Is it context sensitive insofar as you said, like if you wanted to edit HTML or Perl, is it context sensitive or syntax sensitive so that it would actually highlight and colorized so it makes it a little bit easier to edit, or is it pretty much just black and white plain text type editing?
No, it does do colorization and highlighting. It's not as good as, it doesn't do all the ones that are available out there. I've seen other text editors that can do a myriad of ones, but they have the majority in PS Pad.
Okay, well that's good. I was kind of curious why you put that one on there, because I do use a lot of different ones, and they're certainly better out there from a programming standpoint that I use frequently, but for overall ease of use and portability, PS Pad, PSPAD, right?
Correct.
Okay, cool. So where do we go from there?
Now the next one up is System Information for Windows, or SIW. Now this one doesn't really, it's like the spacemonger of information. Spacemonger was a tool that really couldn't get much media because it was released really not very much. I'm sorry, can't find the words today. But
hey, my world, and welcome to it. It's like every episode of Ben Rev Radio I've ever done, I stumble over everything I say, so it's not like our listeners are definitely used to hearing it from me, so you're doing pretty darn good.
Media attention, but it should. It is a must. I give it to all my other admin where I work, and in order to operate efficiently, you have to use this tool. What it does is gives you so much information on the computer you're currently on. everything from a breakdown of your system information, what ActiveX modules are installed, any open files currently, even your LSA secrets, it dumps those.
Now, from Windows,
now,
of course.
This is not picked up by any virus scanner or anything, because it's not a virus. It just tells you all your... It basically, it's not a hack tool. It tells you the information about this computer that you're currently on, and it needs administrative rights. So, but that's not it. That's not all it does. Down in the network section, it has a hardware, a software, and a network section on this information. Mm-hmm. In the network section, you can issue a network neighborhood scan. So I can find out all the computers in my network neighborhood. I can then, after that, scan that network neighborhood for FTP clients, HTTP clients, NetBIOS clients, Oracle, EPCOM, and it goes on. I can also do the same thing with TCP view. Is it's not live, but it shows me a dump of all the NetStat information.
A dump
you can
of
also
it.
With
okay.
this. I'm sorry. With the
no,
also
actually,
with this tool, you can export all the information into an HTML document. So this is just basically your quick and easy audit of a computer. And it's free.
Yeah, and that's a utility designed for, you know, people that are running labs or in charge of maintaining computers and stuff like that. It's probably who it's originally designed for, but it does a great job of footprinting, it sounds like, and telling you a lot of information.
Definitely. And have you ever had a computer where you had to rebuild it and for drivers were?
Of course.
Or couldn't find the... Well, this thing outputs the driver information as well. So I do this on any new computer I get. I really quick open up SIW, hit export about 2 minutes later because it does all these nice little utilities on the computer itself. I export it. I save it to my USB stick, and I'll never have to try and guess what's in my computer again.
Cool. Now, just to re-clarify, because it's pretty much says it right in the description, it's called software information for Windows, so this is a Windows. Is it bound to any specific versions? I mean, does it work all the way up to XP? I'm assuming it's not supporting Vista yet?
I have not tried it on Vista. However, I have tried it on XP and 2000, and it works on both.
Okay. So that's something. See, that's one of the ones where you probably would want to update it as new releases come out, because it's going to have more information about different versions of the operating systems that you want to deal with or pulling more information. So that sounds like a pretty useful one as well. And this next one actually is very familiar in name anyway. And what is that one?
BearGrep. And this is another one that's little known to the community. Grep is known across the world. Everybody
right.
knows what grep is. But when it comes to Windows, you really don't have a grep solution. You got Fine, but does Fine really do what you want it to do? Not really. Say I have a log file. I'm trying to find who hacked my website, and I'm all pissed off.
Haha, your website got hacked.
Yep, I'm on Zone H. I'm defaced. I'm pissed. I want to find out who. Well, these hackers aren't smart enough. They didn't erase the logs or whatever. They didn't have access to them. I have a 200 megabyte text file of logs I have to go through. Now, grep on a Windows, Linux machine would do this without sweating. But find or opening it in Notepad and doing Control F, not going to happen. Bear grep solves this. It even allows you to do multiple files very easily. Right now, I have it open, and I have the O folder or old drive selected. Files are *.*, and I can just start typing. So I start typing like Smart or Mubix. If I start typing Mubix, it will start finding before I even finish. any file or folder with MUBIX in it. Now, say I want to audit my whole network for anybody who stores their password on their My Documents or whatever. I can set up my folder to say, hey, this shared drive or this computer or these sets of computers, and search for any text with password in it.
Right.
And I've done that. I mean, very, very fast, very useful, and the output is file-based, so it says, in this file, on this line, and it shows you the line. You can use full regular expression support, invert match, and in our case.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
All right. Well, we're talking about a lot of these are like useful from multiple viewpoints and things like that. What about some other things that are a little bit more specific in purpose, I guess, for lack of a better word, a little bit darker?
All right. So most people you have used or heard of Netcat. It's a Swiss Army knife of PCP, basically.
All right.
Well, what people don't know or don't realize very much is it's portable completely. I have it on my USB stick, and for those who don't know, Netcat can't listen or talk on any port or protocol with simple, and it works under Windows. And I hate Windows, but it's just the industry standard, so it's easier to use anywhere. But I use Netcat for all kinds of file transfers. I can use it for file transfers or trying to fuzz a specific attack or protocol or traffic. It's just a great tool that you can use for anything, basically.
Well, it is what it is. I mean, it's Netcat, but yeah, just the idea of using it portably is kind of interesting. And actually, you and I were talking about this next thing you had on here. I'm sorry, go ahead. I was saying the next thing that you were going to talk about here, we were talking about offline before for protecting the information on there. So, I'm sorry, go ahead with what you're going to say and apply it to what we were talking about, how you kind of protect your own USB stick with it.
All right, so on my... So TrueCrypt is a way of making encrypted volumes either in a single file. I mean, I can encrypt a load of data or applications or whatever and put them encrypted, and it'll look like a single file, but I mount it just like Linux, and it'll look like a drive to Windows.
Right.
Or Linux. TrueCrypt is both Linux and Windows.
Mm-hmm.
So how I use this is more to the point. When, like I said before, Portable Apps has something called Portable Thunderbird. Well, with Thunderbird, you have Enigmail. Enigmail is a plugin that adds on PGP or GPG, to be precise. So dealing with that, there's keys. You have your public and private key. Well, I don't want to be without my public and private key so I can send and receive email. Well, am I going to keep two USB keys and drag them around everywhere just so I can be portable with my email? Not very efficient way of doing things.
Right.
Well, how I tie TrueCrypt into this is I make a file, which is a TrueCrypt volume, on my USB key, and I put my keys inside that TrueCrypt volume. So when I take my USB key around, I don't have to worry about losing it, and then my keys are invalid, because I know that, one, I have it backed up on my iPod, two, anything that I have that's important that can get those keys or my private keys available to them is encrypted beyond the point that a normal person without a supercomputer can get at.
Right. So, point being, if you lose it, you're not necessarily in any trouble, really.
Right. I don't have to worry about it at all. I don't like losing USB keys, but
right.
I'm not scared that any information on there is going to be disseminated.
Right, but you know, if it fell out of your trunks while you were swimming or something like that.
Hey.
Somebody grabs your USB key, somehow dries it off, they can't completely own you.
Correct. And I store all kinds of information, like any keys that I get for Windows or valid keys for Windows or games or stuff like that, I store in there that just so I can keep my keys private to me and always have them.
Right. No, that's actually a really good tip, and that's why I said you and I talked about that earlier, and that's actually something I can see myself doing as well.
Well, it's a lifesaver. I'll tell you what, you learn after you get burned.
All right, and what else you got?
All right, this is a actually agitating subject for me.
Uh-oh.
Next set of applications. I find it very angering, if that's a word, when I see on dig.com or news or any other forum, how do I get around my firewall at work or school or whatever? I mean, there are so many times where I've gone, just fucking Google it or
yeah.
Just, you know, and I get mad because they don't, people just don't see that it's everywhere.
Right.
So this application is this set of applications is how I would suggest users get around their firewall, which I don't suggest they do at work.
Well, we're not going to tell them where. Yeah, we're not authorizing or telling anybody. We're just throwing out the possibilities here.
With that, I'll go into it.
Okay.
Portable Firefox, again, from portableapps.com, is the portable version of Firefox, obviously. Well, you have that option of adding all those add-ons and plugins and extensions, if you will, like a normal install of Firefox. Well, Foxy Proxy is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before Foxy Proxy, implicating myself, I've suggested using other tools such as Provoxy and another proxy tool or Switch Proxy for Firefox.
Right, I've used Switch Proxy.
Now, the problem with a SOX proxy, which is what SSH or PuTTY using SSH sets up when you port forward. So let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
I have an SSH server at home, a Linux install or a Cygwin on Windows space, and I port forward on my firewall so that it's port 22 is available on my local or home network.
Right.
I use PuTTY from whatever my laptop at, say, Panera Bread, and I SSH to my home computer.
Right.
Now, I log in, and I change the settings on it. Let me get this right. Under connection, under SSH, under tunnels, I turn on local and remote port, and I add the source port as 8000 or whatever you want. And what this is basically saying is I'm going to listen on this port on your local machine, and I'm going to set the destination to blank because it's going to assume that the destination machine is the machine you're SSHing to, and I'm going to change it to dynamic. Now, what this is doing is saying that anything that I see coming in on port 8000, I'm going to tunnel through my SSH.
Right.
My SSH connection. So, now that I've tunneled port 8000, or opened up port 8000 on my computer, and anything that goes to it is going through to my SSH server, I use Foxy Proxy. Foxy Proxy, I set that up to basically set up a... And I don't know how many of your users or listeners might know what a Fox server is, but it's a basically a proxy server. Now, the problem with Fox is that any DNS requests will still go out through the normal means. It won't get proxied.
Right.
So that's kind of loud still, because you're still saying, I want to go here, but once I get the IP, I'm going to go. And it's easy to see on a log file where there's 30 DNS requests but no connections out once those DNS requests are made.
Right, right. And they will see the destinations. They may not be able to see your packets and what's contained within them, but they'll see where you're going.
All right, so it's your computer is going to say, whatever the Panera Bread's DNS server, I want to go to binrev.com.
Right.
Okay, the DNS server will say, binrev server or binrev.com is this IP address. After that, your computer will tunnel any further through that IP or through your SSH tunnel out through your SSH server's ISP connection to binrev.com IP.
Right, but
so all that's going to get logged is on that DNS server is a request for an IP.
Right, that DNS server is going to reflect that somebody looked up binrev.com.
Correct.
Right, that's what I was saying. That's going to still show up.
Okay.
But everything else subsequently is not.
Right.
Okay, so
and
we're on the same page.
That's the problem. You don't want people knowing where you were going. I mean, that defeats the point of tunneling. Unless you're just doing it so that you can log in securely.
Right, and it depends on what your motives are, of course. You may or may not care about that, but yeah, go ahead with what you're saying. You're absolutely right.
Well, with Foxy Proxy, there's a setting, and it's kind of obfuscated. It's down in the settings. You have to find it. And it says tunnel DNS traffic as well, or something of that nature. I'm sorry, I don't have it right in front of me. But you click that on, hit OK, and you're set. All the DNS traffic will from then on be going through your proxy, your SSH tunnel.
Right.
And that is the best way to securely, from, say, Panera Bread, tunnel all your traffic home and out through your firewall, which you know is secure, and none of your traffic's going to be able to get sniffed.
Exactly, because it can't see what the traffic is, so it can't filter anything out or stop anything. Now, actually, I think we're probably running short on time here. We kind of had a little hiccup in the recording, so my timing is a little off here. But before we wrap up, are there any other things we wanted to mention here? I know we talked about updating software when versions come out, whether you should or shouldn't, and sometimes you don't want to. We talked about maintaining and backup and things like that. we talked about carrying around your PGP and GPG keys. It's very handy, but a good way to protect them using TrueCrypt. Are there any others quickly, like in a minute or two, that you wanted to mention before we get out of here? I hate to rush you, but...
The only two we had left was PT Lookup and PT Hasher. Both you can check out at Karen... Where, that's KarenWare.com, and they're both good tools, and we don't have time to go through them, but check them out. That's PT Lookup and PT Hasher.
Okay, and then the only other one I wanted to mention was what I've done in the past is I've used the distributed.net clients and Folding at Home or any sort of distributed computing programs, if you will. They are usually very portable, and pre-configuring those with putting all the configuration files to put your name and join group, DDP group or whatever for Folding at Home. And I have had that on a USB key. And when I'm out somewhere, if I'm in a computer lab, I'm on a school campus somewhere, I'm in a public lab, coffee house, whatever, where they have computers available, you can throw that bad boy on there and put that machine to work, pounding out some packets. So that's always been pretty handy as well. And I think also worth mentioning as we kind of close up the show is there are already a couple of projects worth mentioning over on the Hack5 forums. Is that right?
Oh, yes.
Pimp those quickly.
The Hacksaw and the Switchblade. These are two projects that are on the Hack5 forums and in Hack5 episodes that allow a USB key to be auto-run and do some interesting things.
Very cool. So go check that out. And speaking of closing out the show, I think we should probably do some shouts here. So I'll go ahead and go first and stall for you to think of any shouts you want to give out. I want to give shouts out to E-Man for helping me out with doing some encoding for me. To Enigma, of course, good friend over there in the Tampa 813 BR813 meeting. And I guess anybody whose handle begins with E is the theme tonight. If your handle begins with an E, you get a shout out tonight. And I got to give congratulations to Mr. and Mrs. Droops for their birth of their healthy baby girl. So congratulations to them for that. And what do you got for shouts?
I got just one shout out to Cyber Eagle. Again, his nick kind of starts with Eagle or an E.
there you go.
That's the only one I could think of. Cyber Eagle, if you're out there, shout out to you.
Okay, and our site of the week comes from our co-host at centralops.net. That's CENTRALOPS, centralops, all one word, .net. There's some handy little apps over there that you can play around with. Email us if you have any kind of feedback, if you want to talk about the that whole disclosure topic we had at the beginning of the show, if you have any other tools or any other software packages you want to mention. I'll go ahead and preface this saying that we had to draw a line, a cutoff of how many things we could talk about on this episode of the show. We might have some subsequent shows with a little bit more specific areas and types of tools we may go into some more detail about. But we picked some of our favorites on this one. So, but if anybody has any they'd like to recommend, by all means, contact us, radio@binrev.com, or come to forums.binrev.com, start a thread, any information that you have on anything to do with the show, like how much you hate me and how much you love Mubix and you want me off the show and you want him to run the show from now on, email us, radio@binrev.com. There you go. And see, I'm going to put you to work, man. You didn't think you were going to get away doing one episode and that was it. You're on for life now. You're in the family now. Closing music this week.
Done.
The closing music this week is We Have the Technology by ADD. And I think that is going to do it. Mubix, thank you for being on the show with me. And joking aside, we will have to do some episodes in the future. I know we've got some other tools to talk about, some other topics in general to talk about. But we will have to save them for a future episode. But until then, we will see everybody next week. Same hack time.
Same hack channel.